You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hello out there in Archaeology Podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for your episode 170, can you imagine, of the Rock Art Podcast. And we're blessed and honored to have Robert Yowie, a longtime friend and a colleague, both in context of his scholarship, and I've been associated with him for quite a while, and he's just a brilliant researcher. Robert, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you so much for those kind words. Alan and I go way back.
Oh, yeah. I meant every bit of it because we know each other sort of intimately. We're both in the town of Bakersfield, believe it or not.
Yes.
Where the sun never sets.
That's right. It's 112 right now, actually.
We're only a few degrees less than the temperature on the sun or over on Death Valley, right?
Yes.
Oh, my word. So kick it off, Robert. Let you go.
No, I was just going to say we were just talking about, you know, we've known each other almost 50 years. And there was a period of time that you took a hiatus from archaeology and then came back full force. I mean, when you returned with a vengeance and have been a force of nature ever since. And I think that's terrific.
I tried to make up for lost time, Robert.
I
knew with that 20-year hiatus, I go, man, I better, you know, put my pedal to the metal and get this thing out here.
Yeah, no, you did, and you succeeded. And that's not always easy. A lot of people would not have been successful in that. And you came back full force and have made some very important contributions to the discipline.
Well, one of the earliest things I did post my episodic delay was to do our Humboldt Basal Notch Biface article.
Yeah.
We did together. And that was interesting. I don't know why that started it, but it just seemed to be something that was nagging and needed to be corrected, no?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it was based on, you'd read an article of mine. It may have been the 1998 synopsis of my dissertation work at Recording. And we got to talking about Humboldt basal notch bifaces, and it kind of took off from there. And we ended up getting special permission. And, thank goodness we did it when we did, and got to go to the Southwest Museum.
Yeah, we did. We went to the Southwest Museum and looked at the Mark Raymond Harrington Little Lake collection in terms of what those look like. And that was rather unique and interesting because you can't really do that anymore, can you?
No, there's no accessibility to that material, unfortunately. So our timing was perfect because we did it in the early 2000s. I think that paper came out, correct me if I'm wrong, but I want to say around 2004.
Probably,
JCGBA, Journal of California and Great Basin Anthropology. And that kind of started it off. And then we worked on various projects.
Since that time.
I became involved with, for at least a brief period of time, with the rock art dating. Remember, I got university funding,
right,
so that we could, you know, use the technology out there and see if we could be successful in using fluorescence.
That's gone full circle because early on I worked with a pioneer using the XRF, and that gentleman never published anything, but it was a paper that I was co-author to, and the date seemed rather reasonable. And then fast forward, there's another gentleman who was on a previous podcast who's using that technology again with a little bit of, you know, refinement, and did it in the Middle East and twice in the Great Basin, and we've come up with some rather reasonable assays. So Robert, we were right there on the cusp of the development of dating rock art, which is rather a difficult thing to do.
Well, especially when we're talking about petroglyphs. I mean, that's that's always been the nightmare. I mean, at least with pictographs and, you know, paintings, there's usually some kind of organic binder that you can extract something to get a C14 date.
You
know, some organic that you can get from that, especially with the advances in accelerator mass spectrographic analysis.
Yeah, the AMS radiocarbon dates.
Yep, absolutely.
Will allow us with a minute amount of organic material, we can get a date.
Absolutely. And,
believe it or not, the South Fork of the Kern River at Palakuch, they paid me to do exactly that. And we demonstrated that particular painting site, the largest in the South Fork Kern River Tobalabal country, is 1,000 years old.
And that's fantastic. I mean, that's literally incredibly important. That site in particular, and I'm glad that you were able to do that, because that's one, if it's the one I'm thinking of, that one is vulnerable because it's visible. I mean, you can see that one from the highway.
You can see it from the highway. Yeah. It's sitting there above the river. And I think its claim to fame is it's the largest painting, I think, in the entire South Fork Kern River territory.
Did you publish that?
Yeah, it was published in an obscure way, but published nonetheless.
Yeah.
I think it was the Kern County Archaeological Society.
In the days when we still did that.
But Robert, I think you need to segue and talk about your amazing association with one of the most pivotal sites for, I'd say, the Western Great Basin, and that is Rose Spring.
That's an interesting story in itself, how it came about that I returned to Rose Spring. I mean, obviously, it had been investigated before by UC Berkeley back in the 1950s and early 1960s, but it had laid dormant for nearly 30 years. And unfortunately, it's one of those sites that was extremely popular with the local looters.
Oh, wow.
And so looting intensified. Looting had been a problem at the site. I've got documentation that goes back to a diary in 1921, where a gentleman talks about, you know, at the end of the, after having a Sunday picnic, he took the family to Rose Spring to collect arrowheads. And
there you go.
Yeah. So we know that it was known early on, and it has been utterly decimated by looters, and it's been looted and relooted. But
yeah. But somehow you gleaned remarkable elements of that site.
Well, yeah. And what's interesting is that I had no intention of working at Rose Spring. In fact, this all changed in 1986. Mm-hmm. And it happened at the Great Basin Anthropological Conference that was being held in Las Vegas that year. And Phil Wilkie, who was my mentor at UC Riverside, had attempted in previous years to initiate excavations at Whipple Mountain Cave in the Chocolate Mountains there along the Colorado River in southeastern California. And it became a political hot potato, and the Colorado tribes were not happy about the whole thing, so it didn't happen. Long story short. But there were some inquiries made, and it sounded like they might be interested in having us re-examine the possibility of doing an excavation there. What was important about that site is that there were maize cobs on the surface and Pleistocene fauna at the base of the deposit, which was about 2.5 meters deep.
Wow.
So that was the original plan. But what happened is when we got there, Fritz Riddell pulled Phil and I aside and said, Robert, you need to go back and re-excavate Rose Spring for your dissertation. I said,
oh,
what?
Oh, my word.
And he said, no. He said, it's important. it's an important site, and we just barely scratched the surface. And I'm afraid that with all the looting that continues to go on there, that if someone doesn't go and do something quickly, then we're going to lose a very important part.
Yeah, it'll be completely lost.
Of Great Basin, Mojave Desert, northern right. Mojave Desert prehistory. So
in your dissertation, I know you refined and documented and supported a chronology for the entire Western Great Basin.
Yeah, the idea was to, one of the things that had always interested me was the change in technology from the dart atlatl weapon system to the bow and arrow. And it's something we knew just based on what had been done previously in the West, that the bow and arrow was a recent introduction, that it wasn't any earlier than 2,000 years and probably less than that. And so Rose Spring was a perfect spot to test that particular issue, because Locust One has an archaeological deposit that's 11 feet deep. I mean, it's over 3 meters.
Wow.
And what's good is that it's both culturally and physically stratified. I mean, there are four distinct...
strata.
Yeah, it's four distinct, natural strata.
Yeah.
And then within those natural strata are archaeological strata. Now, has there been disturbances taphonomically? There's been, yes, absolutely, between burrowing and a number of burials that determines that, were put into the site. But for the most part, I knew that if I could go back and get some features that were bona fide, intact features and get radiocarbon dates, that I could peg when the bow and arrow was introduced into the Western Great Basin.
And you'd also help all these archaeologists who are trying to date their sites. We could cross correlate with certain temporally sensitive artifacts, which is unreal. And you had the site at your fingertips that you were able to do that, which was incredibly valuable. The other thing I just want to quickly mention is Rose Spring is at the edge of the Coso volcanic field, the Coso range. And so it integrates, or sort of a contextual element, for a variety of reasons that seems to be rather important or supportive of some of the research questions we have about prehistory in the Coso
range. Exactly. Especially with respect to the exploitation and...
oh, yes.
Essentially, disappearance of bighorn sheep in that region.
Oh, yeah. We can get into that one. That's a wondrous topic to get into. God bless you.
And one of the things that I was very fortunate to have was access to a radiocarbon lab, because at that time, UC Riverside had a radiocarbon laboratory in its anthropology department, which
is
virtually unheard of.
And it was Rainer Berger's
student, R.E. Taylor, a professor there, and he basically took the lab from UCLA and moved it to Riverside.
Wow.
And I was able to make a deal with Dr. Taylor. He was on my dissertation committee, and the deal was I could have as many radiocarbon dates as I wanted, but I had to learn the process and do them all myself.
Wow.
Actually was a blessing in disguise, because not only did I get my radiocarbon dates, but I learned so much about the physics and chemistry behind radiocarbon dating that most archaeologists don't have a clue about.
No, when I read your papers and your dissertation and other things like that, you can just tell about the intellectual sophistication you have about the dating technique and the insider's view of the nuances. Let's kick it off and just take an abrupt segue. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Hey, gang, this is the second segment of episode 170 for your Rock Art Podcast and the Archaeology Podcast Network. And I'm your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. We're blessed and honored to have Robert Yowie with us, professor and just a gifted scholar. Robert, kick us off.
Okay, well, we were talking about radiocarbon dates that we were fortunate to get at Locus 1 of Rose Spring. And again, that's the deepest part of the site, which is just about 11 feet in depth before you hit sterile soil. And as I was mentioning, I think we got 14 radiocarbon dates from that deposit alone.
What was the range of dating? What's the oldest date and the youngest? The
oldest date is close to 7,000 years.
Oh, my word. Wow.
When you do the correct, when the calibration, you know, BC, it's around 6,600 years old. So that's, and what's nice about that, it was on a feature that was resting on sterile soil.
Fantastic.
So that kind of clinched it and made it. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't earlier occupations. It's just that you'd have to go considerably deeper probably to get to those. And it was dangerous enough for us to try to dig at that depth. We were having to shore up the side walls so that we didn't have to worry about them collapsing in on us. When you've got, 3 meters of deposit hanging over you in sidewalls, that's
not good.
Intimidating.
Yeah. But now, when I bumped into you at the SCA meetings, you came over to me and you said, "Alan, I've got a little surprise for you."
Yeah, I did.
Yes, that's
what
you said.
And,
yep.
And it was one of those things that I could, at the time that I recognized, or what I thought I recognized something important, I realized that my mentor would, chew me up and spit me out if I even considered mentioning such a thing as a bighorn sheep shrine feature. But what happened is that we were excavating out of necessity on the periphery of the locus, just because the top meter of the deposit was completely obliterated. So we had no in situ data for the last 1,000 or 1,500 years. So we needed to find a part of the site where we had intact deposits. So we went all the way to the eastern margin, and thank goodness we had intact deposit there. And just above a meter, I hit the most amazing thing, which was the top of a bighorn sheep skull with the horn cores.
Right. And it wasn't just a bighorn sheep skull that was in the deposit.
No.
It was sitting upon what?
It was sitting upon, as it turned out, a stone plinth.
Yeah, a spire of stone.
Surrounded by stones, and with what appears to have been a ritually made Humboldt basal notch biface.
And it was an offering. It was sitting there.
It was
a beautiful projectile point with they call it a nipple tip. It was never used. And it was sitting there almost adjacent to the base of that feature.
Yeah. And as we dug, it ended up, the feature continued, and it was built, the plinth had been placed within a hearth, and it had stone construction around it. I mean, it was quite elaborate, and I thought at the time, gee, this just, first of all, that bighorn sheep horn core, you don't find the top. When you find bighorn sheep remains in most archaeological contexts in the Great Basin, particularly in the Mojave Desert, the bones are so broken up because people were trying to eke every little bit of fat and protein out of that bone. So they were busting up the bone and boiling it to get the bone grease out of it. So you don't get complete large mammal remains, or very rarely.
No, and the skulls, or the, you know, that particular aspect of the bighorn sheep is considered to be highly religious, highly powerful.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You can't really get a more sacred aspect of that animal.
And it was purposefully chipped away. It had, you could see where it had been worked. It was like the thing had been given a craniotomy.
Yeah.
With the rest of the skull being absent. It was just the portion that had the horn cores, and it was clearly from a large male.
Now, what makes this all the more important is it's sitting on the edge of the Coso Range. Which has been in the news.
A few miles from Bighorn Sheep Rock Art up the Wazoo.
Right. So, and as most of us, the people that listen to this Rock Art podcast know, that's one of the greatest concentrations of prehistoric rock drawings in the entire Western Hemisphere, probably a couple hundred thousand. But the thing that makes it all the more important is many of those, I wouldn't say most, but many, if not a huge share of those depictions on the rocks are bighorn sheep or the people that were associated with hunting those animals.
Yes.
And they even have examples which are so amazing. They have one panel that shows a hunter really showcasing or dealing with a sort of a post-mortem ceremony when he's dealing with the bighorn sheep skull on the top of a pole. Can you imagine?
Yes. Yeah, it's truly amazing. And so to find this feature, but I couldn't really say much about it. It was
no.
And it wasn't really related specifically to what I was looking at my dissertation, which was, did the introduction of the bow and arrow, if we were able to determine when that was, and we were able to determine that about 1600 years ago, the bow and arrow shows up. And so there's a fairly rapid dismissal of the atlatl and dart in favor of the superior hunting technology. And it is interesting that you find this, you know, the date of the hearth that was associated with this plinth is just about the time, or shortly after the time, the bow and arrow had been introduced and was in common use.
And that's probably the interface, or what we feel archaeologists have pinpointed as sort of the end of the Newberry and the beginning of the Hayley.
Right, exactly. And I think that that's also when we begin to see the problem of efficiency in hunting.
Yes.
And
yes.
Because you start to see a decline in the bighorn sheep population, which really begins to show up archaeologically in terms of faunal remains at surrounding sites. So
this was a huge controversy for many years, and it's still probably not widely accepted. But way back in 1968, the people that documented the Coso Range rock art came up with a hypothesis that the native people probably were contributed to the local decimation of those sheep, and that there was a quite a dramatic transition or to a smaller game. Am I correct?
Yeah, well, and I think one of the reasons that we're leading up to this, the old, and everybody thinks it's an outdated idea, but it's not, and that is, we're looking at hunting magic here. And what's wrong with that? I mean, if you draw them, they will come. As I always tell people, think of the movie. What the heck was the name of that movie?
It was the one on baseball, right?
Yeah.
And they fantasize for this. Yeah.
If you build it, they will come.
They will come.
Well, in this case, if you draw it, maybe they'll come. And
maybe
they'll
come.
They drew a lot of them. And not only did they draw them, but they drew them being hunted.
Right.
And I think that's important. And most of them, there are a few that are drawn that are being hunted with the atlatl and dart.
Yeah.
But the vast majority are being shown being hunted with the bow and arrow. So
what,
I think,
and what happens about that time, just sort of the, you know, sort of segue, is the rock art explodes. Yeah. There was many more sheep represented than ever before. There's panels that have 20, 30 sheep. And there are sheep that are as large as life-size animals sitting in big Petroglyph Canyon. So it, and so there was something
not
big.
Only that, there's also an emphasis on pregnant sheep, which, again, speaks to you don't only want the sheep to come back, but you want the sheep to come back and be fecund. You want fecundity in your sheep, and you, so you want them to be pregnant to make more sheep.
And yeah, reproductive symbolism.
Absolutely, absolutely.
This all came as a segue, and I don't think any of us really intended. It was the data speaking to us. It wasn't anything that we had, you know, petitioned or somehow planned as a part of our research design. Not at all.
No, it was something literally I stumbled back over. It was one of those things that I literally had forgotten about. But then when I started, I haven't mentioned this yet, but I'm in the midst of working with my good friend and long-term colleague, in fact, my original mentor, Mark Sutton, on completing the Rose Spring monograph that not only addresses all of the material culture from locus one, but all the other seven loci as well. So it's over 500 pages long at this point. But the good news is that we're in the editing phase. So right now we're going through and doing some major cleaning up and trying to get all of the figures lined up with the text. And we've got well over 100 figures. I just told Alan earlier that we've got 131 tables, data tables, and that's, you know, in addition to the text. And I don't think we even, I don't even think that number includes the 60 or so pages of references. So, yeah, and thankfully, it looks like the American Museum of Natural History, fingers crossed, will be publishing it in their anthropological papers series. That's the plan at this point. So,
so fortunately, you have a prestigious outlet to you know, distribute such an important development. And after so many years has have, you know, gone by the by.
Oh, yeah.
But there's such an amazing realm of important data in that site.
Yes. Yeah. And we, you know, we barely scratched the surface. There's just so much. And that was the thing, is that there for three seasons between 1987 and 1989. My philosophy at the time was, this is probably the last time anyone is going to excavate this site or excavate it to the degree that I plan to.
Got it.
And in the next 40 years, it's going to get wiped. It's going to get wiped out by looters.
Exactly. Let's stop there and see you on the flip-flop, gang, for segment three. God bless. Hey, you guys out there in podcast land, this is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for the third segment of episode 170 with our guest scholar, Dr. Robert Yowie. And in this part of our discussion, we're going to talk about what this research really means and what makes it so significant and interesting. Kick it off, Robert.
Okay, well, the implications of the data that we recovered are just so, cover so many areas, from raw material use to changes in subsistence to addressing questions regarding the gnomic expansion, for those who still believers around still that believe this is a reality. But one of the things that just, and we noticed it right away, this is just one of the implications, is it, Rose Spring has been so important in the past that scholars have gone to it as a resource to develop some, you know, major theoretical perspectives. Case in point, Bomhoff and Bettinger, you know, because Lanning, and here's an interesting factoid that most people probably don't know, and that is that the monograph that was written by Edward P. Lanning, first of all, Edward P. Lanning was not a Great Basin archaeologist. He was a Peruvianist.
Oh,
you know, he dealt with Peruvian civilization.
Wow.
And Incan culture, and he was a guest scholar at Berkeley.
Wow.
In the late 1950s. And Fritz Riedel had excavated the Rose Springs site in 1956, and then because of its great depth, Bob Heiser thought that there could be an intact Clovis component, or at least some kind of Paleo-Indian aspect to the site that might be intact. So he sent a couple of graduate students, led by James T. Davis, 1961, to dig yet another trench at Locust One to see if, you know, he could find this, you know, Paleo-Indian stratum, which didn't happen. One of the problems is that, again, once you get to 11 feet in depth, you're in dangerous territory. And I know that these guys, you know, it was basically, I think they were there 3 days. And so they were digging a trench that was 5 feet wide and 15 feet long.
Wow.
And so, and 11 feet deep. So think about that for a minute, those of you who excavate. And so, and one of the frustrating things about that particular excavation is that it was never drawn onto the site map. There's only a verbal description of where it is located. And so I had to take that verbal description and try to reconstruct where I think that it was. And fortunately, when I was working on my dissertation, Jim Davis was still alive. And I, you know, put on a site map where I reconstructed where I thought his trench was. And I sent it to him. I said, "Does this look about right?" And he responded by saying, "Yeah, that looks pretty good. I think that's about where it was." And unfortunately, that's as good as it gets.
So what research questions or what significance is the Rose Spring site?
Well, I wanted to... The point I was getting to is that the issues that we run into, Lanning was very competent, but he was never at the site, you know, was given all these data. He was literally waiting for his collection from Peru to come up on a steamer up into San Francisco Bay. And so he was twiddling his thumbs. So Heiser said, "Hey, Riedel dug this interesting site in the northern Mojave, and we'd like to get it written up and published. Would you like to go ahead and do that for us since you're waiting on your material?" And he said, "Sure." And he did an excellent job, especially for, you know, doing it cold and not being a North Americanist.
Right.
And not having a background in California Great Basin archaeology. So my hat's off to him, especially in terms of the chronology he developed, which actually turned out to be quite accurate, even once we did the radiocarbon dating. But there were some issues early on, and that was, you know, Lanning talks about, one of the things he states is that all the milling equipment, there's very little milling equipment at the site, and it's all in the upper part of the deposit.
Right.
Well, that was taken as gospel by certain scholars, and they use that to come up with the idea that, you know, subsistence involving seed processing was a late development. But the reality was, we got to the site, one of the first things we noticed in the back dirt from the 1956 excavations was that it was full of groundstone.
Wow.
Point being is that they didn't collect it. I don't know if they didn't recognize it. And here's the deal. If you're working in the Sacramento or the Bay Area doing archaeology, the groundstone there looks really different than the groundstone in the Mojave Desert, especially the Western Mojave Desert. And there's a lot of really crappy groundstone that a lot of people would miss.
Right.
I mean, a lot of competent archaeologists would say, well, this is nothing. When in fact, yeah, it's the real thing. Look closely. You'll see that has been, you know, it isn't pretty, but it's a mono.
This is a reevaluation or a re-strategizing of the changes in subsistence settlement relating to that earlier period.
Yeah, right? The reality is that when you take a look at the data, milling equipment was important throughout the occupation for, you know, over 6,000 years.
Wow, that's wonderful.
So that, you know, kind of throws a...
A monkey wrench.
Yeah, it throws us a monkey wrench into the cogs of some of the theoretical
ideas that have been
proposed based on those data. So,
and that's been standard practice when you read anything that the Paleo-Indians and the early Holocene was dominated by hunters and little in the way of plant foods.
Yeah.
But you found that was the opposite.
It seems that things were more complicated and that seed processing had always been important. In fact, Dr. Sutton and I gave a paper on that at the last SCA meetings in Palm Springs here a few months ago. But that's just one of the things that has come out of, you know, the work, and also the other loci. We've been talking about locus one all of this time, but for at least two of the three seasons, since none of those other loci had been evaluated, they hadn't even been looked at. I mean, if you take at the beginning of, or actually after the introduction, Fritz Riddell writes a short, site report about, we went out, this is what we dug, this is how we dug, and oh, yeah, by the way, there's a bunch of stuff up on the hill south of the spring. And that was it. No, that bunch of stuff, we're talking about a huge area, 400 by 350 meters in size.
Wow.
With, all these different activity loci. And one of them was, at least two of them were village size. Wow. So, and huge, but they have been so horribly damaged by years of looting. And so we were, again, forced to excavate on the periphery. But as luck would have it, there was a lot of intact deposit. Unfortunately, the archaeological deposit, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, if you were excavating, was much more shallow because you hit bedrock at about 60 centimeters.
Okay.
So, and it's all late. There's, yes, of all the excavation units that we put in at all those other loci, we only got one dart point base.
Oh, wow.
Everything else, and hundreds of arrow points.
Wow.
So
there you go.
Or I shouldn't say hundreds. We got, I think we got over 100. So, they're all later in time and represent a completely different time period for the most part. And that's about the time that at Locus One, after about 600 years ago, it's like someone left and didn't come back. It was, you know, the archaeological deposit, you could see it in the sidewall.
What you just said is enormously important because other researchers have testified that last period of prehistory was the dominant level of activity. And what you're saying is absolutely the opposite. Go ahead.
Well, at least at that locus. I mean, there's a lot that's going on in those other loci that are south of the spring that are during that time period.
Right.
But whatever was going on at locus one stopped happening. And is that due to the Nemic expansion? You know, where you've got this huge increase in population, and then you've got a major retraction in that population. I mean, these are all questions that the data are helping us explore as we, you know, put this monograph together.
Absolutely. That's one of the nagging questions that archaeologists have about the Coso Range in general, about the whether it was indeed abandoned, as the earlier researchers have testified, or if they continued activity there all through the through contact.
Yeah, there's activity. It's just at a different level.
At a different level.
And the other thing that people don't realize is that once the bow and arrow becomes the main weapon system, then you don't have to go all the way to the quarries to get your raw material, because the debitage that was created during dart point times is just the right size to make arrow points. So you
can,
the site becomes, and we've verified this by doing double obsidian hydration readings on remnant detachment scars versus the most recently worked edge. And interestingly enough, in every case, the arrow points, you know, date to a later time, and they're all made on debitage that date to Newbury times.
Yeah, but it demonstrates that it was scavenging that they were doing to repurpose the older debitage, the older flake waste, and then use it for arrow points, right?
Yep.
So that's an enormous contribution to, you know, support that particular position.
Yeah, yeah. And most people don't think about that. And that's another advantage to my working at the site, because I am an experimental archaeologist and I do actualistic studies.
You're a lithic technologist and a flint napper. And you, when you look at something, you know what it takes to produce it.
Yes, exactly. But most people don't. I would encourage you, when this comes out, to rush out and get a copy. I'm not getting any money out of this, so it's not about that, but it is about, you know, kind of changing the current view that we have of that region. I think that the data that are coming out of the site are showing us a completely different picture than had been evaluated in the past. So based on previous excavations. And our excavations provided more rope. And another thing that we did, and I probably run out of time. I was going to talk about the protein residue we did and got all the projectile points and got all the bighorn sheep results.
Did you?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
We'll have to bring you out for the next follow-up.
Oh, yeah.
That'll be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, God bless you, Robert Yowie, Professor Yowie. And thank you all for tuning in for this grandiose discussion on Rose Spring and the Coso Volcanic Field and all things archaeological. See you in the flip-flop, gang.
Thanks. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.